So there was a series of mails that was sent yesterday. I don't know why those question marks are there, but anyway, those are the statistics for the midterm that I just returned to you. Assuming it's normal distribution, which obviously is a huge bias, we would assume that for the undergrads, the average is about 43.7, standard deviation is 16 marks, okay? So okay. And then for grads, it's 55 and standard deviation is 18. My exams, especially the in-class ones, tend to have very high standard deviation. And so this is not surprising at all. And so there would be, so for example, in this particular case, there were 6 in 60 to 70, 1 in 50 to 60, 10 in 40 to 50, and 1 in 30 to 40, 5 in 20 to 30, and 1 in 10 to 20. Okay. And then in the grad side, essentially, you have 4 in 70 to 80, 0 in 60 to 70, 3 in 50 to 60, 2 in 40 to 50, and so on. Okay. And then I also pointed out, I gave the midterm solutions that are available on the web. So you can look at them when you get a chance. And then if you think I got something wrong, please do let me know. And then finally, I gave the current cumulatives for the class. Current cumulatives for the class, and that's how they look. And these are the top ones are the undergraduates, and the bottom ones, these are the graduate students, and they're all listed in terms of the posting ID, which is the secret number only you are supposed to know, and you also sometimes don't know, which is fine. The only thing is that we are done for about 41 points up until now. I mean, approximately, as I mentioned in my mail, the exact weights may change a little depending on, you know, how many more projects, etc., we'll wind up doing. So if you assume that project 1 is 10 points, project 0 is 1 point, which is what I told you in the class, that much won't change. And homeworks are all 5 points each. And then midterm is 20 points. That's how I took it right now. If you do that, and if you weight them, and this is the percentages. And so that's the totals, and that's the percentages, assuming that the semester ends right now. That's how you are. Okay. And it's interesting clustering sometimes. Like here, there's a 92, and then you fall to 70, 80, and then blah, 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 77, and then fall to 62. So, you know, I guess it's in the beginning right now, things might change. It's not a dense distribution right now, but we have some points right now. That's all the information that you probably need, probably more than the information you probably need, but I gave it to you. Question? Okay. More likely than not, some of you might be worried about how you're doing in the course, and this is how you're doing. And I guess you want to know what is my grade, and I don't know what your grade is. To the extent you're worried and you have questions, please do send me an email and come and talk to me. I'm not going to tell you what your grade is because I don't know what it is, but I could give you some indications as to how things have worked in the past. Okay? And in general, I basically am a strong believer in setting hard exams and then giving grades even if you don't get 90 out of 100 than setting easy exams and put a threshold for 97 and above is A and 96 and above is B. because in the later case, I think you're just deluding yourself. You're not learning anything. I'm asking you what's 1 plus 1, and one of you make a silly mistake, and then you lose the grade. Okay. So I am more interested in making your life miserable during the semester than afterwards. So that's the way it was. Okay. Any other questions? Any questions at all? Okay, so what we're going to do today is actually doing Bayes network inference. But before that, there was this one thing that we sort of left it unsaid. There is independence assertions in Bayes networks, and I only showed you this slide here previously. Remember I said there's a couple of independence assertions that you know for sure will hold. Okay, for example, a node is independent of its non-descendants given its immediate parents. That will hold. Okay, and I also said a node is independent of everybody in the world given its Markov blanket. Okay, now it turns out that actually, in fact, these two are enough to design inference algorithms. Okay, in fact, which is the only assertion we have used till now in designing our inference algorithms? I mean, you start off figuring out how to do the Bayes network inference. Which of these did you use in doing the Bayes network inference until now? What? A. Why? Because you always converted a joint distribution entry, a full joint distribution entry, into a product of the Bayes network conditional probability table entries. And in doing so, you use this rule. Okay, and then if we get to the end of, towards the end of the class, if we talk about Markov chain Monte Carlo, we will actually use the Markov blanket idea, where basically you would wind up sampling a node given its Markov blanket. Okay, and those are about the only two rules that we wound up using in actually designing the algorithms. But there is this, it would be interesting to ask yourself the question, exactly, you know, what are independent and what are not independent? I understand those hold, but what else holds? Okay, in particular, if I'm given a network like this and I ask the following question, is burglary independent of John calls given earthquake? Yes or no? Is burglary independent of Mary calls given alarm on John calls? Yes or no? Okay, I want to be able to answer all these questions. Okay, now, if you remember last class, we talked about a different version of graphical models called Markov networks. I mean, we didn't really talk about it. We sort of alluded to them, okay, which are undirected models. And there, it was actually quite easy. It turned out that if you have suppose you have a network like this, right? All you need to do to ask, for example, is A independent of B given E, then all I need to do is act as if you removed E from this graph. If A is separated from B, if you remove E, then it's independent. If not, it's not. This is a simple graph theoretic notion of separability. Right? In particular, in this particular case, A would not be independent of B given just E because it can go like this. Right? But on the other hand, you cut both of them, then A would be independent of B. Okay, so independence is now being connected to the notions of separability. And in the context of Markov networks, the normal notion of graph separability just holds. Okay? So for example, this no, A is independent of B given E and F, yes. Okay, so that is good. So in fact, in some sense, the thing that I just alluded to in passing, I wound up giving you more information about it than the thing that I've been talking a lot more of, right? Bayes networks, I never talked about the independence assertion computation in Bayes networks. Okay, whereas in Markov networks, it's just graph theoretic separation, and you have any idea as to if you remove those nodes, will things be separated? Okay. Now, in general, actually, the notion of graph theoretic separation also can be generalized for Bayes networks. Okay. The tricky part, of course, is basically in the case of Bayes networks, essentially you have to generalize the notion. You have to generalize the notion. Okay. So let's look at what sort of structural things are actually there in a Bayes network. So here is a network that you know and love by now. And then here is a more general part of a more general network. Okay. And I would essentially, what I'm going to try and do is I'm basically going to talk in terms of given, let's say, if I'm asking is A independent of B. Okay. Then what I'll try to do is look for all the paths between A and B, ignoring the arrows on the edges. So for a while, it's assume as if all the arrows have disappeared. So just look at all the paths on the network. And then A would be independent of B if every one of those paths is blocked. Every one of those paths is blocked. Now the question, all I need to now know is how do you block a path? In the context of Markov networks, the way you block a path is remove a node from that path. Okay, so if the node, suppose here, for example, A to B, this is one path here. If I remove E, this path is blocked. Okay, and similarly, if I remove F, then this other path is also blocked. And if I remove both E and F, then all paths between A and B are blocked. And so A and B become independent. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so in fact, that also makes you realize that you don't need to actually cut E and F, you can cut E and C. That would be just as good. If you cut E and C, A and B would be independent of each other. So all you think about is blocking of paths. Okay? And blocking paths in the context of normal undirected graphs, Markov networks is easy. It becomes slightly more interesting in the context of Bayes networks. That's why I didn't talk to you about it until now. But finally I thought I might as well say that, you know. Again, while we are going through this, understand that this is more for you to understand independence assertions in the network rather than in actually designing the algorithms, because to design the algorithms, you really need only those two assertions. Okay. So now, for example, X and, you know, X, now again, one other thing, of course, is that I can not only talk about a single node being independent of B, another single node, but I can also talk about a set of nodes being independent of set of other nodes. In that case, you're going to block every path starting from one of the source nodes and ending in one of the destination nodes. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in that example, for example, A and C are independent of B and D given E and F. Because every path starting from one of these nodes and ending in one of these nodes is going to be killed because E and F are in the evidence. You already told me about it. So in some sense, blocking is given by the evidence. Right? In Markov networks, the way you block a path is you take a node on that path and make it part of the evidence. That means you observed it. Okay? That's almost true in Bayes networks too, except in some cases. Okay, so let's understand why that happened. Okay, so here are basically, it turns out that if you take, you know, a path from X to Y, okay, and then actually first consider all the paths without looking at the arrows, and then I would basically look at, so in this particular case, from X to Y, there is a path like this. Okay, now it's passing through the evidence node, Z. So now where it is passing through evidence node Z, I want to check how is the arrows coming in and going out. Now there are three ways. Given an evidence node, both arrows can be coming in, both arrows can be going out. One arrow is coming in, one arrow is going out. It turns out that all three of them have beautiful names. In fact, you have intuitions about what those mean. Okay? So here is a path where the whatever happened, starting from X, going through Z to Y, Z is an evidence node, and then the path, you know, the undirected path, if you look at the direction of it right here, it's going in and going out. Okay? So that essentially is a causal chain. So in essence, the relation between X here and Y here is a, through evidence, is a causal chain. So this guy upstream is causing this, who then is causing this. Okay? Whenever you have a causal chain, you remove the middle node, the path is blocked. Not remove. Remove, in our terms, is to give it as an evidence node. Okay? So for these kinds of paths, it almost works just like this. That means if the evidence node, if a path goes through the evidence node and then it enters the evidence node and exits it, so then it's a causal chain, right? And it's a causal chain, and so it will block it. Okay? And then, so that's that. X causes Y through Z, and if that path is blocked if Z is given. Okay? Similarly, the other possibility that can happen is the two arrows are diverging. What happens? That means Z is the cause of both of them. It's a common cause. Z is causing this side as well as this side. Once again, so first of all, let's go this here. This one, show me a path here which is of that type. Which is of that type. If I give you alarm, burglary would be independent of Mary calls because this path would be blocked. And this is the only path between burglary, this is the only path between burglary and Mary calls. By the way, in this particular network, for any two nodes, there will only be one path. And why is that? Because this was a singly connected network. It's a sort of a generalization of a tree. But in a normal network, there can be multiple paths. And every path has to be broken for the guys to be independent. Okay? So in this case, of course, burglary is going to be independent of Mary calls given alarm. That's what, because that path basically goes like in and out. There's a causal chain between burglary and Mary calls. Okay? Now the other one is this. Okay, so basically Z is causing both this side and this side. So I act as if I first find an undirected path between the nodes and then suddenly look at the directionality right at the evidence nodes. Okay, so if I do this, then if in fact both of them are going out, that's a common cause. And once again, if you give the cause, then that path is basically blocked. That particular path is blocked. Okay, so this guy would be independent of this guy if Z is causing both of them and you know about Z. Now you might be asking, what if there is something else also causing them? Well, that would be taken care of by another path. And if you block that too, then they will be completely blocked. So you first consider each path being blocked, and if all paths are blocked, then the nodes are independent. Okay, so now in this case, tell me an example in this network where that holds. So John calls is independent of Mary calls given alarm. John calls is independent of Mary calls given alarm. Okay. What about John calls given, Johnny calls and Mary calls given burglary? Basically, the path between John and Mary calls is going only through alarm. Okay? And in this particular case, this is going out and this is going out. So given alarm, these two would be independent. Okay. Up to here, I would suggest that Bayes networks are just like Markov networks. You know, you gave some fancy terminology, but the moment the network, there's a node which is on the evidence, things become independent. Okay, now consider the following. Now let's look at this now. Suppose in this world, if I don't tell you anything, is burglary independent of earthquake? Right? Now I tell you, by the way, there's an alarm going off. Is burglary independent of earthquake? No. Why? Because if you know that the alarm is going off, and you already know that burglary occurred, you don't need the earthquake to occur anymore. You don't need two bullets to kill one person in general. Okay? In general, this basically what happens here is explaining away. Okay? They become dependent because you can explain away one because the other is already occurring, and you know, and you, when you see the alarm, when you see the child, then the parent suddenly become dependent. This is exactly the opposite of what happened in these two cases. Notes became independent when given the evidence. Here, notes become dependent given this kind of an evidence. So, a path where the notes are coming in and going out, coming in and going out, which is a linear path, or both are coming out, which is a diverging path, they are easy because if you, those notes are on the evidence, those paths get blocked. For the other guys, it's the opposite, that's true. If in fact you have a path between these two such that the path goes into Z from both sides. So in essence, Z is a conceptual child of these two guys. It's a conceptual descendant of these two guys. And knowing Z will make these two guys dependent. Not only knowing Z, knowing any of the descendants of Z will also sort of make them dependent. What?
Given alarm goes off.
Yeah. Okay, so here is the idea. Okay? So think in this way. So I suggested to you, upfront I came and asked you, okay, what is, let's see, let me put it this way. So again, as I said, the easiest way to think about this is once you know that alarm is going off, I tell you burglary happened. Do you change your belief about earthquake or not? Okay, if I didn't tell you anything at all, I told you there's a burglary. Do you think there is, does your thinking about earthquake change? No. But if I say alarm went off, then in essence, you can explain alarm by one of these, so the other is not needed. So in essence, you wind up changing your belief. Okay. In fact, this is exactly the example that you need. Remember last time when I was talking about what Bayes networks can't represent, and it is this, where X and Y are independent of each other given Z and W, and similarly Z and W are independent of each other given X and Y. You cannot write a Bayes network that has those properties, but you can write a Markov network that has those properties. Okay, because in Bayes network every node has an arrow, every edge has an arrow, and then you cannot write arrows such that basically both X and Y would be independent given ZW and Z and W would be independent given X and Y. But on the other hand, to say that this is also not enough, I pointed out that if I want X and Y to be independent of each other given nothing, but become dependent on each other given Z, you can't write it as a Markov network. Okay? And that's exactly that special case. Given Z, X and Y become dependent. Given symptoms, diseases become dependent. When you say dependent, all that you mean is that your probability associated with one of the diseases is going to change, given knowing about the other disease. Okay? So what we want in this particular case is for every path, if the path goes through the evidence network, you know, an evidence node, such that it's going in and going out, that path is blocked. Both are going out, that path is blocked. And if there is an evidence node such that both arrows are going in, that path won't be blocked. So you want to make sure that there is no such evidence note. Okay, in these two cases you want evidence notes which will block the path. In this case you don't want any such evidence note. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's the trickier part. Once you get that, then essentially you have thought about what's called the deseparation idea, which is a general idea for giving, for checking whether some set of nodes X is independent of some other set of nodes Y, given just the evidence nodes Z. In this picture, basically, the things in the grid, at the grid area, are the evidence nodes. Okay, and since the only path between X and Y are going through these kinds of nodes, they are all blocked, and none of them are going through this node, so you are fine, because this is not an evidence node. I mean, these paths you don't have to worry because this is not part of the evidence. Okay, so that's basically what that picture, basically that definition is saying. A path is blocked if there's a node Z on the path such that, okay, Z is in E and Z has one arrow coming in and one going out. That's a causal chain. Are both arrows going out? That means it's a common cause. And definitely there is no node such that either it or its children are present and both arrows are coming in. That you don't want. You better not have evidence about it. The moment you have evidence about it, they become dependent. Okay? So these are basically examples of these kinds of things with respect to this network. So B is independent of M given A. J and M are independent of E given A. J and M are independent of E given A. Because every path between any of the nodes here and a node here will have to go through alarm, and that is blocked because alarm is given. Okay? And B is independent of E because there are no paths. So nothing to block. Okay, what I'm saying is B is independent of E because the path is like this, right? And then this one is not part of the evidence. That's why they are independent. The moment I give alarm as evidence, they become dependent. And then these don't hold. B is independent of E given. B is independent of E given alarm won't hold. B is independent of E given Mary calls also won't hold. Because in essence, two diseases become, suppose diseases cause syndromes, syndromes cause symptoms, okay? This particular symptom now could be caused either by this disease or this disease. The moment you know it exists, then you don't need both of them to happen. Okay, so basically what we are saying is B is independent of E given Mary calls too. Okay? So that's the deseparation condition. And if you understand that, you can answer every potential conditional dependence assertion query. Okay? It actually is the case that that these two that we talked about previously, they are just special cases of deseparation condition. And I ask you to prove to yourself that. Okay? That these two, here I said X is independent of everybody given its immediate parents. I mean every non-descendant given its immediate parents. And here I'm saying X is independent of everybody in the world given its parents, its children, and the children's parents. And this is a schema for all sorts of independence rules, each of which will be shown to be true by this rule. Okay? To understand this, let's see, did I put that in? I somehow forgot to save something. I hope actually I have that. Okay, let's look at this. A causes B, C also causes B, Z causes C. Okay? Now, in this network, if I'm looking at A, what is its Markov blanket? Now I can actually also throw in, W causes A. Okay, so what is the Markov blanket of A? W B and C. If I give W, B and C as evidence, then I am saying A must be independent of everybody else. In fact, in this particular network, only guy who left is Z. Okay? So you have to convince yourself that A is actually independent of Z given W, B and C by the deseparation condition. If so, then you know why Markov blanket actually holds. Right? Okay, so let's do that. So how is the path from Z to A? Like that. Right? Okay. Now, there is C which is present on the evidence. C is present on the evidence. So in fact, you would start thinking this is not going to be independent because B is present on the evidence. Right? And then it's going in, and so since B is present, they are not going to be independent. But if a path needs to be blocked just by one way, that's enough. Okay? But C is also given. Because when I give Markov blanket, not only do I give my children, but I give my children's other parents. Because I gave C, now Z is going through C, and C is going this way. So if you look at here, it's a causal chain path. So C blocks it right there. Okay, that's how Markov blanket holds. Markov blanket is really a secure blanket. If you know your parents and your children and your children's parents, then you are independent of everybody else in the world. And you can check that using the deseparation condition. Okay? Yes, sir.
So, in order to do that, we have to first marginalize all the alarm, probability of alarm, to actually get that VA.
No. By the way, you have to understand the difference between knowing the distribution of a variable and knowing the value of that variable. When I say evidence, that means that's been observed. That's actually been observed.
PA has been observed.
Yeah, it's not PA. It's the alarm is going off. You heard it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, there is something that if you are seriously into giving me trouble, you can ask the following thing. What if I don't have very good ears? I thought I heard an alarm. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, it's like I thought I saw a pussy cat, but maybe I'm wrong. You know, that's what Tweety the bird keeps saying. Okay? That is an interesting issue. There, essentially, you will wind up getting a posterior distribution on the alarm observation. I would not talk about it for now, okay? But in general, an observation means you saw it. You no longer are talking about the probabilities. Okay? Other questions? Let me just see whether I have all the things. Oh, good. That's good. Okay, so finally, I'm going to go to the inference task. I was originally thinking I wouldn't do this. It's sort of more conceptual. And as I said, I already said you don't need it to do the actual algorithms. But I think the other day, last class, when I was talking about independence, somebody in the class looked, yeah, we don't know how to do the independence. And I think you should know. It's useful to understand the conceptual underpinnings. Okay. So now let's go back to the inference by enumeration idea because remember in the class, last class, we talked about this slide that anyway we are sunk, it's going to be hard task. It's a, you know, sharply complete complex device. You can write exact inference algorithms. You can also write approximate inference algorithms based on sampling. In terms of exact inference algorithm, you can do simple brute force enumeration. The zeroth idea is to write down the entire joint distribution and then use the elementary probability rules to figure out every other number. Okay. Now, the problem with the zeroth idea is that it actually takes exponential amount of space too. Because if you have n variables, just to write down the joint distribution will require, you know, a table of size 2 power n. Okay, complexity, time complexity wise, we are sunk anyway because it's going to be exponential. The question is, can we at least reduce the space? That's exactly what we did in the search algorithms. We know that blind searches are all sunk. They are all going to die in the end in terms of taking time. You know, all blind searches will take exponential time. The difference between IDDFS and something else, like DFS and BFS, is that one of them takes linear memory, the other doesn't. So if you, in fact, I sort of gave away the cat, basically, that if you ever want to reduce the space, what do? Depth first search. That's it. If you ever want to reduce the space, do depth first search. Okay? So in essence, what happens in this, the idea of inference by enumeration essentially is, suppose on this network, again, Bagley earthquake, alarm, John calls, Mary calls, network. Suppose I'm trying to compute this probability distribution of B, given that John actually called and Mary actually called. Notice that all the queries you ask, these would be observed. And this, normally, you may just want a distribution. Okay, what's the probability that B is true and what's the probability that B is false? Now, you know, for a Boolean variable, if you get one, you can get the other. If it's a continuous variable or a multi-valued variable, you really need to compute all possible values, the probability that each of them is true. Okay? So in general, you'll assume that you'll be computing posterior probability distribution for the query variables. Okay? So how do I do this? Given B, G, and M, essentially, I will know that this is just by conditional definition of conditional probability, it's probability of B, J, M by probability of J, M together. Right? Now, of course, since B is a distribution, this is actually a system of equations. Right? One for B equal to true and one for B equal to false. Okay, but we'll make it easy by just writing, you know, bold letter B means that those are basically distributions. You are computing it for all of them. Now, if you need to compute this, essentially you need to compute this and this, and any conjunctive probability at all can be computed by marginalizing the guys whose names weren't mentioned. That's it. That's how you do, for example, if I'm given the joint distribution for A and B, and I ask what's the probability of A alone, then I marginalize B out. I take P A and B and A and not B and add them up, I'll get P of A. Right? So all I need is I can get this by marginalizing over, since B and J and M are given, I can marginalize over A and E. And I can get this by marginalizing over B, A, and E. But actually, I don't even need to do anything with this. Because we also talked about this other idea that if you are anyway computing the distribution, then you don't need to compute this denominator. Let's assume, remember that for every one of these, B equal to true, this would be the denominator. B equal to false, this would be the denominator. If B is a multi-valued variable, for every value of B, the numerator will change, denominator will still be the same. Right? Okay? I can just assume that 1 over that number is alpha. Let's assume that. Okay? So that's what I did here. Alpha times probability of BJM, where B is a distribution. B has to be taken for both false and true. Okay? And when I am done computing this, I will get two numbers, alpha times 0.7 and alpha times 0.3, let's say. Then, so alpha times 0.7 plus 0.3 should be equal to 1. So I know what alpha is. Right? Okay? That's basically normalization. This is something that trick we know and we can use this here. So we'll assume that's how we'll do it. Okay? So we'll write it in terms of alpha times this. Okay, and then here, of course, I need to marginalize over the other hidden variables that are not mentioned. It's not mentioned in the query. It's not mentioned in the evidence. And so you marginalize over A and E. Okay, that's all you need. Okay, so then, of course, then basically write this. Once you are marginalizing over it, then you just say B, E, A, J, M, and you consider all possible values of E, all possible values of A, and add them up. That's the summation idea. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that this much you already know, sort of. Okay, so in fact, this will tell you which entries of the joint distribution you actually need. And if you took the time to write down the entire joint distribution and stored it somewhere, you just need these values, B equal to true, E equal to true, A equal to true, J equal to true, M equal to true. B equal to true, E equal to false, A equal to false, J equal to true, M equal to true. And at one point of time, I say B equal to true, B equal to false, E equal to true, A equal to true, J is false, M is false. Would I ever need that? No, because I told you J and M are part of the evidence. I will never want J false, M false. Right? I know which particular entries of the joint distribution I would need, and so I can just look at them and, you know, multiply them. But if up to here you are assuming that you stored a huge big table somewhere. But then how did you store that table? That table, B, E, A, J, M, really was computed, basically can be computed on demand, because if I want B, E, A, J, M, A is probability of B times probability of E times probability of A given B and E times probability of J times given A and probability of M given A. That is the golden rule of what Bayes network does for you. It converts a joint probability entry into multiplication of entries from the conditional probability table, which you are anyway storing because that's just part of the network. Right? So why actually go ahead and do all these multiplications up front and store 2 power n entries? Why don't I just call them up as I need, just do the multiplication as and when I need them? If you do that, then you become the enumeration idea. And so in essence, what you're doing here is I'm writing this directly rather than say I can look this up because I have the joint distribution that I have priorly computed previously using, you know, the Bayes network topology. Now I'll say I'll just compute it as an ED. Okay? So I'll just write it out. You know, this is PB times PE times PA given BE times PJ given A times PM given A. How many of you understand this? The rest of you should look at it and realize that what I just said here, this BEAJM, given the topology of the network, every joint entry would be computed as CPT entry of B, PB times PE times PA given B and E times PJ given A times PM given A. That's the whole point of the network. And those are the numbers that you have in the CPTs waiting for you anyway. Okay? So that's what you have here. Now, having written this, now you are a computer scientist, or at least a little better than a hacker. Right? And you realize that, look, there are two summations sitting here, one summation over E, one summation over A. Right? Except these summations, some of these terms here are not dependent on those variables at all. So just pull them out of the summation. Do you understand what I'm saying? You can pull them out of the summation. That way you don't multiply unnecessarily many, many times. You just multiply once. Right? So if you do that, then what happens? You can actually pull them selectively. So for example, PB is independent of basically E and A, so I put this out. I mean, not independent, it's the PB numbers is just these numbers. Okay, they are not dependent on E and A. In fact, what are dependent on E and A? A is dependent on E, E itself is dependent on itself. And then and J is dependent on A and M is dependent on A. But neither of these are dependent on E because once A is given. Okay? So what I did here is I pulled B completely out and then I started summing over E and PE is there. And then the PE, rather than put it here, I put it here because E no longer depends on A. Because, you know, that's an entry that I just already have. So I pull that out and then I write this multiplication. And these three terms do depend upon A. M given A, J given A given B and E. They all depend upon A. When I say depend upon, I'm not saying anything particularly deep here. What I'm saying is the table, to look up into the table, you need to know the value of A. And so you better not pull it out because then what value are you going to look up for? Right? If you do this, in essence, you're doing two things at the same time. You're doing two things at the same time. One, you are computing each entry as needed. And two, you are computing it without doing unnecessary multiplication. So if you actually look at the expression tree, so this is not a single I mean, it's a shortcut here. Basically, there is summation here going on, and there is also all possible values of B going on here. So it actually corresponds to a reasonably big computation. And if you look at what that computation is, this is what it is. For each entry, in essence, you are going to do M given A, M given not A, multiply it by J given A here, J given not A here, then add them up, you will get A given B E here, and add them up, you get A given B not E here, A given B not E here, okay? And then you add them up, and then you multiply by B. That's exactly what you're doing in that. Convince yourself that that's what this thing here is doing this. This is an expression tree. Right? Now, all I need to do is, if I do depth first traversal of this expression tree, I will never do more than linear space. That's all. So I saved you the space. You never really ever have to store a huge 2 power n table. You're just computing it as needed, and that expression, you can actually just do a depth first computation. Okay? This much you should do just because you did CS101. Okay? Right? Now, by doing this, have you changed the complexity, the time complexity? Of course not. You just reduce the space complexity. Okay? Now, the one question, of course, is, while worst case complexity would not change, on specific problems, you could very well be doing unnecessarily redundant work, and you should at least avoid doing that. Now, just because you're going to be sunk for the one worst problem that comes in your lifetime, it makes no sense to be sinking starting today. And, you know, since anyway I'm going to end up, you know, with this really NP-hard problem, you know, exponential problem, one of these days, why do I even care about anything? Just start doing brute force. That makes no sense. Again, if you think that way, you're not a computer science person. Okay? So, while knowing that you don't change the worst case complexity, you still have interest in increasing the efficiency on the individual instance. Never do anything more than one. Never do any multiplication more than one. Okay? Some of the greatest ideas in computer science are all about essentially stopping repeated computation. And they come in all sorts of interesting terminologies, but most of them wind up essentially being a subset of an idea called dynamic programming. And what dynamic programming does essentially is it keeps around intermediate computation so that you don't redo computation. Now, here's a very interesting point to understand about dynamic programming. Oftentimes, dynamic programming trades what for what? Speed. It increases, you know, space to reduce time. So, as we leave this guy, this is the last time you'll ever get to get by with linear space. Now onwards, you started being little more greedy. You said, now that I got linear space, I'm thinking in terms of time, let me get time better. Okay, remember what happened in IDA star. IDA star reduces space complexity to linear. But then we realize that nobody's computer in the world is so small that it only has linear amount of space. What you really need is put a, you know, threshold on the memory and say, I will use all that memory to reduce the time. And then I talked to you, at least I mentioned, I alluded to you about this idea called SMA star, which basically keeps filling up all the memory and then starts throwing out things when memory becomes full. Right? And that one has a higher space complexity, but it has a much better time complexity, average time complexity on individual instances. The same thing we'll do here too. Not exactly that, but basically we will start remembering intermediate computations. And the only way you can remember intermediate computations is to remember big tables. Currently, the only things you are remembering for this problem are the CPTs, which are given part of the problem. Okay? First of all, do you actually see that you're doing any repeated computation here? Yeah. Look at this. 0.9 times 0.7. 0.9 times 0.7. Do you think it has changed in the last two times? Why are you wasting your time recomputing it? Okay. And similarly, 0.05 times 0.01, 0.05 times 0.01. In this particular case, this entire tree, you shouldn't have wasted your time. Once you did this, you shouldn't have had to do this. There is repeated computation. Okay, in the IDA star case, there is a repeated expansion. Just because you have linear space, you keep expanding the root node so many times, or the few nodes below the root node so many times. Right? So anyway, you need to remember the intermediate computation means you will need to remember tables other than the conditional probability tables. Now, there is a spectrum of the table sizes. Right? On one hand, you can remember nothing at all, which basically means CPTs are just free anyway. It's just part of the network. So we'll just remember the CPTs. Or on the other hand, I'll remember the entire joint, in which case I will never have to multiply during the actual query processing. In fact, I would say that if you're stuck with a particular network, and your entire life is going to be answering queries over that particular network, then your best bet is to get a huge big computer with a lot of space, extensionally store the joint distribution there, so that you'll never make a single multiplication. Even beyond that, you actually find that these guys keep asking you one of 15 different probabilities. Just compute those 15 probabilities and store them. Right? You can do all those things. You can amortize if you know that the same queries are being asked, on the same network, multiple queries are being asked. We are assuming that, you know, the network comes and a couple of queries and then a new network. In that kind of a scenario, obviously, you don't want to remember the entire joint. Okay? So basically, somewhere in between is the amount of space you are willing to pay. Okay? And basically, those tables, these intermediate tables, are called factors. Now, in fact, if you think you have never seen factors, conditional probability tables are already factors. Okay? But while CPTs are factors, factors don't have to be probabilities at all. You know, they don't necessarily have to have any probabilistic meaning. You just remembered some intermediate numbers so that you don't have to recompute them again. Okay? So that's basically the idea behind inference by variable elimination. Okay, so all it's doing is it's looking at this and it's computing things bottom up. And any time it computes a structure, it remembers it as a table, a factor, so that you'll never have to recompute it. Okay, so how do I understand that? So again, go back to the same thing. Go back to this last part. This we already know, right? So I'll start from here. B, and a probability of B given G and M is alpha times PB times PE times that, da, 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 da. That's what we just said, right? Now, these tables, these are already tables. Each of these are tables. Some of them are tables with just one entry, some of them are tables with multiple entries. Okay? Now, so I call this M table, J table, A table, E table, and B table. And these tables, we will just call them factors, as I said. Factors can be CPTs, but, you know, CPTs are factors, but not all factors are CPTs. Okay? So in this case, essentially, basically in this case, it's just a lookup operation, but I wouldn't even want to do lookup more than once. Imagine, if it makes you happy, CPTs are stored on the moon. Right? And you have to go all the way to moon, get the CPT entry, and then start doing the multiplication. You don't want to go a second time. Right? And then if in fact on the moon people actually start multiplying whenever you go, then you don't want them to multiply again either. That's both of which you're trying to save. Okay, so I start by saying, okay, this is a factor, this is a factor, this is a factor. And then what's interesting, the first time things become interesting is these three factors are being multiplied and you are summing over A. When you sum over a variable, in essence, you are eliminating that variable from consideration. If you consider both A false and A true, A got eliminated. That's why it's called the variable elimination algorithm. So in essence, what you wind up doing is you'll slowly eliminate every variable other than B, G, and M. And then you have just the table that gives you B given G and M. Okay? So that's why it's called variable elimination algorithm. So in this case, I multiplied this table by this table by this table over different values of A. Okay? Now, what does this table look like? So this is basically summing out. And so I get a new factor called AJM table, where I put a little dash on A saying A went away. You know, this is a table I got by summing over A. If you're getting confused on that, basically what this particular thing does really is just it takes this one, this table really, you know, each entry in this table is of this form. A, you know, ABE times A times, I'm sorry, ABE from this table times A from this table times A from this table. Plus not ABE from the first table plus not A plus not A. Okay? That's what I'm doing in essence. So now I have this factor. And then I realize, I'll get back to, you know, this factor in a minute. But I have this factor now, and then I have a probability of E and this factor, and then E is being summed, and this is dependent on E, this is already dependent on E, and there is nothing on this side which is dependent on E anymore. So I can get rid of E at this point. I can get rid of E at this point, and now basically I get a new factor table where E and A have been eliminated. And basically for different values of B, it gives me the values, right? And now finally, I come here. Okay, then there is obviously, this is the distribution, so for each value of B, I get a different multiplication, one for B equal to true, one for B equal to false. And those are the numbers I get. Okay, so the idea of variable elimination is rewriting this expression by repeatedly eliminating variables until the only things that are left are the ones that you actually are asking query about. Okay? And then, you know, this is kind of painful to see it on the board, but you can write an easy program. It's not at all that hard. Basically, all you're doing is defining tables to keep the intermediate results. Now, of course, the question, of course, is going to be how big can these tables get? How big can these tables get? And it turns out that the tables can get bigger or smaller based on the order in which you eliminate the variables. And so then you will ask, what is the optimal order? I'll tell you that there is an optimal order, but if you are insistent on finding the optimal order, finding the optimal order is also NP-hard. Okay, now come to a nice course where you're sunk and you'll never see light. Okay, but the point of course is you don't need to compute the optimal order. You just need to compute a heuristically better order. Okay, in CSP, you have thought about this. By the way, all this problem has direct deep connections to CSP, which I won't talk too much about in this class, but you can almost see that there are variables here, there are variables in CSP. And in fact, you can talk about a variable elimination algorithm for CSPs. Okay? And what's more interesting is you also know that, you know, the order in which you eliminate, I mean, so order in which you look at the variables, branch on the variables in CSP makes a difference. So you could have asked, what is the optimal order? I did this hand-waving thing and said, minimum remaining values is a good heuristic. But you could have asked, what do you mean heuristic? You know, I want proof that this is optimal. Nobody can do better than that. Then I would have told you that consider all the orders and find which is the best one, and then use it. Which would be just like doing perfect heuristic by doing the entire search problem many times over, and then using it as heuristic to solve the problem once. Okay? So basically, the variable elimination orders, there are heuristic techniques essentially of eliminating them. Okay? In this particular case, how did you eliminate them? You eliminated them in the causal order, essentially. And that more or less winds up being fine. Okay, but not always. Okay? So, a little bit more, when I kind of am multiplying tables, you know, What is actually happening is, what are these table multiplication? Is it matrix multiplication? Is it vector multiplication? Is it something else altogether? Essentially, it becomes close to a join operation, for those of you who know joins in databases. Okay, so for example, if I have a AB table, which says true true 0.3, true false 0.7, false true 0.9, false false 0.1, and I have a BC table, and with those numbers, okay, then multiplying this table by this table, will be essentially a point-wise, what's called a point-wise multiplication, where in essence, since the common things between them are B, you take true true and multiply with true true, I get a true 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 entry. And true false and multiply with false true, and I'll get, I'm sorry, so I can also do true true with true false, and I get a true true false entry. And so on. Okay, now that I got this table, now if I want to eliminate a variable, what do I do? If I want to, if I don't like A, then essentially I'm eliminating, so B, C being true and true is what I want, so I add up this number and this number. Right? That's all I'm doing. So the multiplication is a point-wise multiplication followed by the summation, which just marginalizes one variable. This is the only arithmetic operations you wind up doing in your actual computation. Okay. Now, as I said, complexity of variable elimination, and the whole reason you're doing this is you're remembering intermediate results so that you don't have to recompute them. And the complexity depends on the order in which you look at the variables. And one of the interesting things is when you have worst case complexity results, what you are interested in doing is to be aware of the fact that in the worst case you will die, but if the instance doesn't correspond to the worst case, be smart enough to exploit it. Okay, and the brute force, the truly brute force methods are those which are so pessimistic about the worst case that for every instance they do the brute force way. The brute force ones you understood till now are things like truth table based entailment computation. That's one of them. Or joint extensional explicit joint probability distribution based probability computation. That's another one. In those cases, they will take the same amount of time whether you ask the simplest question or the most complex question. Whereas these kinds of algorithms might get done much faster sometimes and take as much as the worst case some other times. And again, my example was when is which better depends on what's your overall scenario. When would you rather use microwave oven to bake potatoes versus conventional oven to bake potatoes? If you just need a potato for yourself, you use microwave oven. If your whole bunch of people are coming from the class to eat potatoes at your home, doing one potato, another potato, another potato in the microwave oven kills you. So you just, you know, get one of these huge big conventional ovens, throw a sack of potatoes and do it. Okay? And similarly, if I am stuck with a network and I'm going to be asked lots and lots of questions on that network, it makes sense to bite the bullet and store the entire joint probability distribution. That's like buying the commercial grade. I mean, if people keep coming to your home to eat potatoes, you should at some point of time realize either get rid of these guys or buy a really big commercial grade baking oven. That's what is getting a terabyte sized, you know, space to store your thing. And it makes sense, it amortizes in that case. Okay? In fact, what I'll do by the end of today's class is just making you understand variable elimination, which is a little slower than I expected, but that's okay. Next class, we'll come back and do the sampling method and then go into first order logic. Okay, this one, I'm just going to quickly go through this. I want you to go through this slide slowly yourself to make sure that you understand what I said, which is, it's another example of variable elimination, okay, where, as I said, variable elimination is all about rewriting these products so that they depend upon fewer and fewer variables until the only thing that you have left is the query variable. Okay, so here is obviously a much bigger network, and it's also not a nice network, right? This is not a nice network because of what? Not because it's, you know, kind of making fun of Asia, but because of this. There are multiple paths between nodes, and that means in the worst case, there is no polynomial time algorithm for this. But variable elimination works either way. Okay, so now what I would do, and basically you will go through this slide slowly yourself, but I'm just going to, you know, show what's inside. You would want to, suppose I just wanted to compute probability of D given nothing, which is a reasonable query. That's just prior on D. Now I know prior on B and prior on S very easily. What I'm trying to do is push them down up to D. And that is done by kind of marginalizing everybody out. Okay? So here, if you look at this structure, you should be able to write this out yourself. If I need, you know, a joint distribution entry V S X T L A B, it would have to be written as P of V times P of S times P of T given V times P of L given S times P of A given T and L times P of B given S times P of X given A times P of D given A. I didn't look at this. I just read them from there. Right? And that's what we wrote here. You should be able to understand that. Every node given its immediate parents. That's all you need to write. And every node should be at the head of every, you know, at least one of these probability tables. And they can be present in the evidence part multiple times. Yes, sir. What?
Isn't D independent of X given A?
Yeah.
Then why is probability of X given A there?
Yeah, no, no, but I need everything. So if I'm trying to, it's basically I'm trying to compute the joint probability entry. Okay. Okay, I mean, in fact, I'm taking all those independents into account in writing this. You have to make sure that you understand that. Okay, now once I do this, I can start eliminating. Okay, so if I eliminate V, for example, again, I'll try to eliminate in the topological, I mean, the causal order. If I eliminate V, then these two things will be put together. And the way I put together is, since V is not part of the query, I'm summing out the V value. Okay? I'm summing out the V value, and I'm essentially getting a factor table that's only dependent on T. In this particular case, that factor table actually has a probabilistic interpretation. It just happens to be the prior of T in this network. Not always is this true, but in this case that's true. Okay? Now I have a factor of T, okay, and this is what it's saying. Elimination is not necessarily a probability distribution, but sometimes it is. In the beginning there are all CPTs. In this case it's a, you know, obviously a prior distribution. And then I can and so I've done that and I have this. Now I want to eliminate S. Okay, I can eliminate S, I have to take all of these guys, because those are the guys dependent on S. Okay, and then I basically eliminate S over the multiplication of those three tables. Whenever I'm multiplying, I'm doing that point-wise multiplication, a sort of a join. Okay, and I now have these two, then I can, then I'm eliminating X. Okay, and if I want to eliminate X, this is the only thing. Here's a cute idea. When I eliminate X, what do you think will happen? I will be computing this. The factor for X will be just this. What do you think is this number?
One.
Should I be wasting my time computing ones in the middle of battles? No. Okay. It turns out that there is actually a trick. A trick is, before you start doing variable elimination, you can remove every leaf node which is neither in the evidence nor in the query. You can just remove it as if it doesn't exist in the network. And when you remove it, there may be other leaf nodes. You can also remove them if they are not in the evidence or in the query. And you keep doing this, sometimes the network becomes really small. And you just need to do variable elimination on that small network. And if you do that, then you wouldn't be finding out in a costly way that, oh, this huge big summation I computed is 1. Even if you don't do it, variable elimination will work, but if you do this little trick that I told you, you can do much less work. Okay? And then, you know, this continues like that. Eliminate T, and then eliminate L, eliminate A and B. Now, if you are writing this, it, after a while, you start thinking, what the heck am I doing? But if your computer is doing it, that's exactly what it's made for. There's total structure here. Okay? So, variable elimination. We understand that variable elimination is just a sequence of rewriting operations. Okay? You're rewriting by eliminating variables. Okay? And the actual computation is done and in the elimination step. You multiply tables and sum over entries, you know, corresponding to the marginalized variable. Computation depends on the order of elimination. Optimal elimination order can be computed, but that would be NP-hard. However, a heuristic is to eliminate them in the causal order. Okay? And then this is the point that I just made about the irrelevant variables. You can always remove irrelevant variables as any leaf node which is not present either in the query or in the evidence. Then when you remove that, there may be other leaf nodes. Those two can be removed if they are not present in the query or the evidence. Then you get a really small network. Then you can just do variable elimination on that. We'll stop here. Next class, we'll do the sampling-based methods, which are much simpler to understand, and then go into first-order logic. And please make sure you understand this long example I gave you. JSON major?
JSON major,
that's fine. Oh, that's you. Oh, I'm sorry. Ramesh Tulsiram.
Hey, what's this from dividing
topic? So, did your major computation help you in deciding the optimal thing about doing it home or not? You're the guy who sent this long computation, right? Okay. Todd MacLeod. That's it.
Their homework.
No, project 2 is not yet done. Only project 1. Project 1 and homework 2. Yeah, let's walk out and talk to me. Yes, let's come out. Because there's somebody who comes into the office. Comes to this. Right up front. Why don't I just get out to this and you can lift it up right outside the classroom because somebody else is supposed to come into the class. Here you go, guys. Okay, if you want, take them now and then after you're done, I'll go. Okay, somebody had a question. Yes, sir.
So one mark is, I think, you forgot to consider.
Which one?
So this one.
Oh, I didn't add this?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's fine. Perfect. Just send me an email.
Okay.
Okay, I'll just add it. Okay. Thank you.
What do you mean by each stage?
No, despite it, I mean, I'm just reading what is written here, but I think the TA graded this.
Okay.
Only the midterm was graded by me. So.
Okay. How are you doing on the in class?
It's been, I mean, it's going to be done, I guess.
Sounds like a lot of work. Two midterms in a row.
Okay. You got yours?
I got mine right here.
Okay, good.
Project 2.
Oh, they just started grading it.
Just started?
Yeah. I guess because it was only available on Monday, right? So hopefully next week sometime.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Hello. Yes, sir.
I actually have a really, I'm sure it's going to be a really fast question for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's relating to Project 3.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done the first two. I've made the network. I did the one with the Mongolian game.